let me welcome you to the first panel of the first day of the first class of Game Expo here in San Jose. I have been given the honor of introducing two guys who worked on, what has got to be considered a video game system that really has taken an amazing place in classic video game lore. First, and still the only, vector-based video game system. Video game system with vector-based graphics. We know we announced five people from VectorX are going to be here this morning. Well, the two good ones showed up anyway, so may I introduce starting.
I think there were two DUIs and the other ones were out.
Two DUIs. Sitting immediately to my right, one of the masterminds involved with VectorX, the technical designer of the console, a man who knows the system inside and out. If you want to ask any kind of hardware questions about the VectorX, such as how to fix it, why it only shows a little tiny white dot when I turn it on, he's the guy you want to ask, Jerry Carr. And sitting to his right, a man who just told me that he had absolutely nothing to do with VectorX hardware and did nothing but software, so please do not ask him about hardware, but he was the designer and programmer of Scramble for the VectorX console. All right, he's nodding. That means that I got it right. Also designed and programmed Towering Inferno for the Atari VCS, which was published by US Games, and a neoclassic game called Cube Quest, the VectorX version of which debuted 2 years ago, Classic Gaming Expo 2002. Paul Newell. Go for it.
Good. So what are we going to talk about? We haven't seen each other in all this time.
I think the last time we saw each other, Paul, was when you were doing that cards.
I just remember Paul just jumped right into the thing. He had them all the hardware set up there, and his yes, but wasn't intimidated by it. Right into it, which is what everybody needed.
I'm not really quite certain, what you want or what you're expecting. I'll just give a brief little rundown of the horror show that was the VectorX project. Not horror show, but it was pretty intense. I wasn't there, I think, when it was designed, when you, John Ross, and the others put it together. I think I showed up shortly thereafter. The original thing they had us doing was they had I, Mark and Dichter, and John Hall doing Atari VCS games. The idea was reverse engineer the sucker, and they were going to put these things out with Kenner. That's actually where Towering Inferno came from. Sometime in October, Kenner, I think the contract ended up going to DC or something. Somehow or another, it died. So we trashed our offices and went out and got drunk. And they announced that we're now going to be on this brand new system of VectorX, 6502 based, and we have to learn it immediately and have the games done, day after tomorrow. We started working with it, and there was just no way it was going to fly because the 6502 just wasn't going to do it. So we were able to convince them. I think it was not only programmers, but I think the hardware people too. We all agreed, we had to kick it up on processors. So we went up to a 6809, and that was a nice little chip. It really was. All of a sudden, we could actually do things. Things we had thought about, we wanted to do. The clock was high enough. The instruction set was rich enough that actually, I think there was something called 16-bit addressing somewhere in there. At that point, we got schedules, and the schedules pretty much were between 12 to 16 weeks for each game. Six games originally had to be done. It was myself on Scramble, Mark and Dichter had, I am blanking on which one they did. Remember? John Hall was a pole position? No, that was when he was at GCE. John Hall was doing Minefield. Duncan Muirhead, who I had known.
Duncan Muirhead. Yeah, Duncan and I know from graduate school about armor attack, and there were two student interns, Chris King and Bill Hawkins. Chris got berserk, and Hawkins got... I didn't do my homework, I apologize. We pretty much just, you know, just all outdo it, and the hardware was key.
He was getting hardware, wasn't he, mostly? He was working on...
No, well, both, but he did the...
Oh, the Pac-Man knockoff.
Right, that the money thing. It was like yeah. money instead of dots or something.
Right. An attempt to somehow or another do a Pac-Man game and not infringe on copyrights, I guess.
Well, you know, that's the same as Mindstorm.
Yeah, Mindstorm, exactly the same thing. I mean, I was lucky with Scramble because, you know, they actually had a license, so to speak. We had Scramble down there, and I had a friend, I had a friend, Kim Martin, who took the game, put it into, you know, no collision mode, no die mode, and he spent every night sitting there mapping out the entire landscape. I taught him hexadecimal, and he proceeded to code the entire thing. He had an exact replica of the entire thing. He measured every single meteorite, every single ship, when they occurred, what the launcher was. I never would have been able to do the game without him, because pretty much what he gave me was he gave me the essence of what the game was. He told me, this is the way it plays. This is the kind of thing you expect. This is what you have to match if you want the users to actually believe that they're playing Scramble. I still have somewhere at home, I don't know how long the sheet is, it's actually two rolls of paper on graph paper with the entire game laid out, the entire map. They're somewhere in my garage. I don't think they rotted yet. We actually, they'll survive with the cockroaches. We originally had it, the first version of the game was like 6.5K, and I sat there going, give me 8. Give me 8K, come on, give me 8K. And Jay Smith went, yet.
Or him. You were paid by the bike.
I wish.
You paid for the bike.
I mean, my argument was, if you want this game to be authentic, you know, I can't fit it into 4. And Jay's view was, you're going to fit it into 4. And GC's view was, you're going to fit it into 4. So I pretty much spent the majority of my programming time smashing this game down, trying to somehow, you know, cycle counting, you know, moving the code around, figuring out ways you can embed random number generators inside the data landscape so I didn't have to have a random number generator. We made it. I remember I actually, one of the long-standing issues was that when this thing started, they said, you're going to have this game done on this day. And I said, that means I can plan on a vacation the day after. Right. And they went, yeah. So I bought the airplane ticket. And I went up to Ed Smith, Jay's brother, who is currently running us. I said, you signed this ticket. And I don't know what possessed him. He signed it. So I'm sitting there. They're going into a panic, going, we have tested this game. It's like 3 days before. And I'm going, I've got a signed ticket, bud. You know, I'm going back, back to Wisconsin, actually. On vacation. I did my undergraduate dad at Madison. And we found one bug on the day before I left, which I got fixed. To the best, I got off, I flew on that plane. Jay Smith was furious with me, but he really wanted me to stick around just in case there were problems. To the best of my knowledge, and from cruising the website, none of you folks have reported a single bug in this game. Only piece of code I can say that I've actually done that. The tower, just on the side of the Towering Inferno, Jay's kid found a bug in it after the thing had already gone to prom, in which it's, you know, joystick here was getting the score reported here, joystick here was getting the score reported there. They were lost. On that one, I actually had to call up the place where they were doing the prefab and tell them which hexadecimal address to change, what to make it to. Scary. I got it right. But nevertheless, you know, that. So that's a brief history. Now, at this point, please save us and ask questions, because I don't know what more to talk about. And see, Jerry's already running away.
Oh, you didn't look towards me. Did you look towards the thing?
Look towards you.
Well, slightly. You're halfway.
Excuse me one second.
Yeah.
Software guys always go away. We're not to look.
So
Then you got to be designing the hardware.
See, I know this guy. Do you all know this Chris here? He's a Connectrex.com guy.
Oh,
man. Met him last year. He couldn't believe that he got that site. It was available.
But when you guys were laying out the hardware, about how long was it before Paul came along? And how long did it take you actually to go from, okay, we're going to do this project, to having a first kind of breadboard unit out there that would actually do something else besides suck power down from the wall and give it to you?
Well, let's see, to figure that out, you have to go back to what Paul was saying, where it was originally for Kenner, and it was on a 5-inch screen, and like 502. Except the prototype on the 5-inch was 6809, because that's what, personally, I was into that one, that chip anyway. I had a homemade emulator for it, so I liked it already. But we assumed that it would have to be 6502 all along, because that's what everybody used. It's what the Atari used, and a lot of coin-op games use that. And it really isn't a bad chip. I don't know. I still don't know if we might have made a mistake on that anyway, because in some ways 6502 was faster. You know, the cycle. There were cycles. I was off where Kate trusted me, 6809. If I could have convinced him to put a 16,000 inside an op, then I would have done that. Yeah, that was just coming out at the time.
Yeah, because that's what we started. That's what we ended up doing the cube test for Semitrack on the 6809. Yeah. That was a nice chip.
You mean 68,000?
68,000, yeah.
So the length of time is hard to say. I mean, from the time, you know, we've gone, when we picked up the first 1-inch monitor that we picked up, we had 1-inch originally. No, it was always CRT, because that was the whole idea of this thing. That's how the idea sort of germinated. At Jay's company, Western Technologies, we had done what?
Well, the one-inch thing running through my brain right now. Okay,
the one-inch background. Right. It's why we're all wearing glasses.
You're right. I don't know if I can answer the time, the question about the time, but I could say right how it came about, which is why the 1-inch came about.
Well, that brought up another question, but maybe the idea is to go before that even. Why vector? Why did you guys end up just flying on that rather than just producing another raster game or another?
Right. I can answer that.
You can answer that.
Yeah. All right. So we did this other game at the company called Microvision, which is an LCD game, handheld. It was where we had to design a custom driver chip, because the companies at that time didn't think it was possible to have a 16x16 matrix on an LCD. They said you can't multiplex it that high. It's impossible. You know, now everybody has color cell phones and everything, but at the time it was supposed to be impossible. So we designed our own chip that was manufactured by Hughes and made this Microvision. And it was also the first handheld game that had cartridges that you could change. The way we did the cartridges is we put the whole microprocessor in the cartridge. So there was only the LCD driver chip in the game. Because at that time they didn't have 4-bit chips that you could have external memory on. I mean, they did have the Intel 4004, but that wasn't really a 4-bit. That was a microcomputer rather than a microcontroller. So it didn't have, it was, you couldn't use something like that in a game. I'm digressing. The Intel 4004 also is not really what came to be known as a 4-bit computer, because in the toy business, the 4-bit computers actually had 8-bit instructions. And they just had 4-bit data. So that's what we had at Microvision, was a 4-bit microcontroller from Texas Instruments, TMS-1000. If everybody wants to know that. I don't see anybody taking notes, but. It's okay if you're just recording it, you transcribe all this later, that'll be all right.
So how do we go from the MicroVision to Vector?
Okay, so then in MicroVision, then we wanted to go to the next. That did okay, actually, Bill and Bradley. So we wanted to come up with the next thing. We came up with a 32 by 32 color version of MicroVision, which actually worked. And it was that was really impossible, because the 16 by 16 was already impossible. And the color, we used this principle of Bayer fringes that I think somebody read about it somewhere, and it's a way of putting different types of polarizers. And we had to stretch, you had to take a piece of plastic wrap and stretch it just a certain way, and you put that between the polarizers, and you can make the thing into color. It turned the grayscale LCD into color. So it's pretty tricky, but it got a prototype going, and that was not well received at Milton Bradley. And that was one of those, we just couldn't believe. It was one of the big shocks of my life, my young life at the time. I could not believe it. I still can't believe it. It's just rejected, and it wasn't even rejected. They just kept it. And we never, and didn't use it. So then the thing was, well, what do we do now? And then we tried a projection LCD that was 32 by 32, black and white. Thought maybe it needed to be a bigger screen. But then, you know, we really were all for the toy business. It was Western Technologies was a toy inventing company. So Jay didn't believe in putting in a fan, because that wouldn't be like a toy. It could be dangerous or something. So there was no fan in the LCD, so when we fired up the prototype, it exploded.
That's why there aren't very many prototypes left.
It was actually like a 1960s, late 60s rock concert or something with those blobs. You could see the blobs of the LCD growing and getting smaller, and then finally the whole thing just blackened. So then, but then there was still a thought that, well, maybe if we just had higher resolution, you know, then you could somehow make it, get something that would sell. You know, we were just always trying to sell ideas. In the middle of all this, Jay was selling like a sit and spin to Kenner or something, or we were doing game watches, or that might have been later. That might have been later with the game watch. But all types of toys were being designed constantly. There were music toys for Milton Bradley being designed, which were a lot of fun. But so it was always toys, toys, toys. I said, well, how can we get something cheap that has higher resolution than this 32 by 32, which is already pushing it in terms of the cost? What can we do? And then it was like one day it hit like a meatball from the sky in Zap Comics. It was, CRT. CRT has any resolution you want. Just have to move the beam. Could be any resolution. So that's how that idea came about. I mean, obviously everybody else in the world uses CRT, so you might not think it's such an original idea, but for us it was an original idea.
One part of your question was why we did that instead of just doing raster. At that point in time, you're dealing with the Atari VCS, so pretty much that's the level of technology in raster. Motion is just not good. I mean, it really wasn't that good. It was nice colors and all that, but the motion was really pretty much up, down, left, right. With the vector, we lost all ability to have any color, but man, we could move that thing around. We basically could just have motion doing things that you just couldn't possibly do in raster at that time. And so for that reason, and that window in time, vector, I think, was a really interesting thing to approach. Clearly, in the long term, technology has eliminated the need for that. You can now do anything you want in raster. It looks gorgeous. But at that point, you really, really couldn't. So, it just was a matter of the raster technology hadn't done what was necessary to give you the kind of motion that you'd get away with in vector. For example, during that time period, the computer animation houses, which were just starting up, for example, Eagles, they were doing all their stuff on an Evan sub vector machine. And they just run, they take the thing, they go down to the optical printer, they colorize each pass there. Why? You can get far more detailed and interesting kinds of images in vector. You just couldn't do that in raster. It wasn't until, really wasn't until 85 or 86 that SGI with their machine basically took over that end, and you could begin getting that kind of thing. And my memory on games is sometime a little bit before that, the game boxes began getting good enough and the color and motion was rich enough that you really didn't need vector. Yeah, but that's my personal opinion. It was just a very good window in time for doing it.
So your original idea for the Vectrex was like a handheld
sort of deal? It was supposed to be handheld or handheld. Battery operated. Well, the one is, we never. No, so once the idea was on the table about the CRT, then I guess it was Ross and myself. Ross mentioned that he had seen that over at R&L Electronics, a one-inch CRT. That's a place where we just went and got all our surplus parts all the time. So we went over there and bought one. And it had wires coming out the back. I think it was electrostatic deflection tube of some kind, or another. Yes, because it was really long. It's like this long. One stand. So it really wouldn't have been that great. But of course, the thing about the one inch is that if it is electrostatic, at least you need less voltage because you're only deflecting. But we never did actually build it with the one inch. If I implied that, I should correct that. We didn't actually make the thing. We had the tube there.
The tube just was motivation,
but
never actually got done.
Yeah, we could have done it. We would have actually, but of course it would have been stupid with the long thing sticking out. But you could have gone with a one-inch magnetically deflected. The magnetic deflected tubes, which is like everything that you see, are shorter because like an oscilloscope, not anymore because they're all LCD now, but the old-time oscilloscopes were all electrostatically deflected. That's why they're always so deep, because you just couldn't get that much deflection because you had these plates attracting the electron beam and repelling it, so you couldn't really, if it came too close to the plate, it wouldn't work anymore. If it was too far away, it wouldn't work either, so it could only deflect a little bit, so that's why it had to be long. So we could have gone with a one-inch magnetic, but meanwhile, Jay didn't like the one-inch idea, that it was too small. So with 5 inches. See, Jay was a very, very important. I mean, besides funding the thing, he did make a lot of crucial decisions which somebody had to make. And sometimes he didn't like his decisions, like telling you not to go on vacation. Except that wasn't a decision. He did it anyway.
Yeah, I have a signature. Jay really did shepherd it through.
Yeah,
I give him all credit for taking a bunch of unruly kids, a very difficult time schedule, a brand new technology, and somehow or another hitting that target date, and basically, there really weren't any problems. I mean, he did a very, very good job. Tip the hat to him wherever you are.
He's not here. He's supposed to be here. We should be insulting him.
if he shows up in person, then we'll insult him. And since he's not here, we'll praise him.
Yeah. We did make a 5-inch, 5-inch model. It was called Mini Arcade.
Was that actually a 5-inch?
5-inch. It was a monitor by a company called Ball.
Oh.
They made a monitor.
The real 5-inch, an actual 5-inch.
It was a real magnetic 5-inch tube. It was like about this deep, 5 inches, and it came with a deflection circuitry in it. So all that was necessary to do it, to make it, was to just rewire the yoke for vector instead of raster. Now, and also, see, I have a different perspective on the raster from Paul. I mean, I completely agree with everything Paul said about the raster, because it's true. It was a unique time then when you couldn't do detailed things. But my main recollection is that it all fit together. The cost was also a big thing. Because if we were going to try to clone a VCS system, first of all, that was impossible because the development time to try to clone that was ridiculous, right? We couldn't have done that. But even the hardware cost was also too high because, you know, they weren't selling a TV. So they had their cost down because they were just selling the game, and their cost kept getting cheaper every year when they got a higher quantity of the chips and they simplified the circuit board. We really stuck with the CRT, so that was another reason for the vector. It was just simpler once you figure out how to do it the cheap way, which I have to admit was my job, part of my job.
But you did well.
It was like, how do you, you know, we looked at the asteroids, which is what we were trying to rip off.
Rip off.
It was a blatant rip off. But see, we didn't look at...
That was another game, right?
We also did the game rip off. We didn't look at it like ripping off, because as Paul was saying, we were young kids. We thought we were young. We weren't that young, actually. Probably 30 or something, late 20s, but we thought we were young. And the people who made the VCS, we didn't know who these people were. Yeah, we've heard of Nolan Bushnell, but it just seemed like that's another world. We were just doing our thing, trying to do what we could do.
This was a great opportunity for a bunch of kids to come in. Here's this brand new system, and just pretty much just go on and walk with it. I can remember doing early development in which I was working in an oscilloscope because we didn't have any hardware. And the entire thing was hardware coming and software is coming, changing all the time. It was a great experience. It really was. And kind of a unique opportunity to be able to do something like that.
You know, the changes were difficult because we had people like Paul. Were there 12 other programmers or were there 12 games? There weren't really 12 programmers, right?
No. If there were, those were the ones that showed up after us. There were originally only six programmers.
Six. So you had to do two. There were 12 games that had to be out by June. Long Ridge Code was by June. And in January, the hardware wasn't settled.
All the way through until the end of the game, John Paul and I shared a machine. And he did the morning shift, I did the night shift. We never had enough systems to be able to do it. So there was a lot of this... making ends meet with what you have.
Yeah, and we had Mike Purvis, the technician, who was building these things. And then but he had a limited schedule. He had to solder between tokes. So
this was the 80s, yes.
he was probably the
worst. Now, are they still out there, or are they owned by somebody?
Yeah. Actually, I currently work up at Disney, up in animation, and I went down because I needed some. I can't remember what the piece of hardware I needed was for my office. Something was wrong. Something was broken. I can't remember if it was the mouse or whatever. And I walk in, and the guy at his desk, he's got a Vectrex beside him. I'm sitting there, what are you doing with that? He says, "Oh, I love this thing." And I'm going, oh. I talked to a friend who works. It was actually Chris King, who. Now Pixar doing very well. Since when he showed up, there's about four of these things in the company floating around. They are out there. There are people who are devoted. It's a very small group, but they're definitely there. They seem to have an amazingly long life. And the games are, you know, there are games out there. There are people still doing more games, I gather. I find it hard to believe, but if they're doing it, bravo.
And they've done amazing games on this thing. Stuff that we didn't have time for in 3 months.
I mean, if people can push that technology and come up with, you know, really tasty games that actually have good gameplay, I'm all in favor. I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, exploited to its heart's content.
Do you have any interest of going back to it and writing another game? How big a pizza would we have to buy?
Pizza. Pizza was what we got fed in grad school. Yes and no. I mean, if I were to suddenly walk in and there was a development system and it was working. And using it didn't require me to spend weeks upon weeks upon figuring out. Basically, if there were an easy way, it might be a real hoot. For me, it just strikes me as trying to do anything would just be, would end up turning into taking up every bit of waking and sleeping time. So sort of this avoidance of wanting to do it because it looks like it's more work than it's worth. However, that being said, it was a fun little thing to program for. I mean, it really was a nice, clean system, and you could just do some marvelous things. Duncan did this one, I've got the prom somewhere at home, of just this rolling wave pattern. Is it out?
No, just like, I'd be happy to
contribute. It's just this wonderful sort of thing, sitting there trying to play, how can we deal with curved lines? How can we play around with getting this beam and not going ding, but actually try to begin doing it? He wasn't doing splines. I mean, we couldn't put that kind of process in. Maybe now we know a little more about it. But it still was trying to play around with curves and see what you could do by just deflecting this beam on the fly. It was a very nice little test, and we all kind of looked at it and went, gee, there's all these interesting things. So does that answer the question? Yes and no?
Sure.
You heard me. Okay. First off, allow me to say for the record, anybody who says Cube Quest, the Simutrek version, is a great game is lying through their teeth. It's one of the worst games in the universe.
The guy who made it was that California Extreme last year.
And it had a lot of potential. It had the hardware is phenomenal. I mean, basically, it was a line buffer with microcode. And this is before frame buffers were really out there. We could do some incredible things, but this was a case where the schedule bit us. We had to put something out. Duncan and I did not have enough time. We just begun to figure out what we could do in the microcode to have all these graphics running when we're being told, you've got to ship this thing out. So, it has potential, but that's it. The story behind the CubeQuest version of the Vectrex is when we showed up at Simutrek, it was a startup company, six of us sitting on the floor, pizza. That's how they bribed you to do startups back then. And there was no hardware, but we had a really bad schedule. So what they did was they struck a deal with GCE, which is let us just have the Vectrex. We'll go ahead, we'll do an emulation. So I wrote the sort of overall cube switching logic and the cat and mouse aspects on a Vectrex as a proof of concept so that we had something to move over to the 68000 and the hardware if and whenever it came up. That just ended up sitting, it literally was one of those things that goes in your garage after. The company went bankrupt, but the problems were sitting in my house. Because I wanted to hold on to them. And it just sat there, and then the people from GCE found out about it. And they said, hey, can we release it? And I said, if we can put this thing out without my having to do one iota of work, you have a deal. I have three proms. If you can catch an image on it that works, we'll do it. And they caught two out of the three still read. And so that's how CubeQuest ended up. It is the prototype. I personally think it's far more interesting than the arcade game. It's a very nice little cat and mouse. It's just kind of an interesting, oddball little game. Maybe I'm just partial to it.
What about the evolution of the controller? Because back then, there weren't a lot of analog controllers, especially with four buttons on the console.
Yeah.
How's that come
about? I'm a little shaky on that. I probably would just say maybe, I don't really remember. And maybe it was Jay.
That's hardware. just give me a working controller. That's all I care about. I don't care how it came.
Sometimes things happened then because they were possible. It became possible to do it because we had a DAC in there that we're using to write the vectors. So digital analog converter. And so that could be also used to read, we're using it to read other things, or that could be used to read the analog joystick, which it was. Although, you didn't really, there's other ways that are easier to do that. So I don't know if that's really the answer either, because Somebody, it may have just been to Jacob. Were there were no arcade, now you all know all the arcade games from back then, right? Yeah. Were there any of them?
Arcade games had some consoles.
But did they have the analog?
Yeah, arcade games, they were.
Okay. So we must have just thought it would be
cool. Yeah. I mean, the other thing, I'm not certain of this for a fact, but the other thing is if you have this Vectrex console and you open up the player and you've got your little joystick, you've got a lot of real estate there. And I'm certain one of the things they thought was, is there anything we can do with this real estate? You know, it's just open room, so if we just put a bunch more things in there, that's a good thing, because we already have to use the space anyway. They couldn't get away with just doing a small one for just the joystick, because it wouldn't fit in the width of the 9-inch monitor.
Then it could come with two controllers.
And if you had did, unless your technology, the Vectrex would have been completely different.
I have a follow-up question. I noticed that the joystick port is dual supplies, plus and minus 5 volts. Looks like it might have been really flexible trying to aim for future expansion or something.
Oh, this is where, you know, where they wrote that with the mastermind of the hardware and everything. You have to, last year, they had some schematics posted up on the wall. I went to the show last year also. It was not in, this is embarrassing. See, there are some hardware questions I can answer. I didn't even remember that it had the 5. Is that right? It has minus 5 coming out.
Yeah.
That's true.
You get the pot centered around 0 volts if it's not plugged in.
Okay. So the op amps are operating off of plus and minus. I wasn't sure about that. If it was the single supply. I was about to research before this thing because I didn't think anybody would show up anyway. And then, you know, the panel didn't show up. So, Paul wasn't here. Wouldn't have happened. But, I don't know. What was the question? Why is it 5 volts coming out? What about the goggles? Did they run off the just plus 5? Does anybody know? Well, we planned on the light pen and possibly. John Ross was always talking about the goggles, I think. I think he was always talking about them. Or did that come up later?
I can't remember. I think I may have been gone at that point.
Well, we were always talking about the light pen. That was a big thing, because we had actually a computer in-house, some computer from some Georgia company somewhere, I can't think of their name, and that had a light pen. We thought light pens were cool.
They actually did come out with a version of the light pen.
Somebody
gave me one. I remember plugging it in and going, wow. I mean, it's not, you know, it doesn't exactly behave that well, but it sure works. You know, I just was sort of like, this is really kind of neat.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it was cool. You know, in a light pen, you know, you have to write, does everybody know that a light pen doesn't write, it actually receives. You know, what's in the light pen is like a photo transistor or something. So, you have to have your beam scanned down to where the light pen is. But since this was a vector thing, we could, once it found the light pen, you could assume it wasn't going to move until the next scan, so you only had to have a little ball scanning around where the light pen was. So in a way, that's kind of cool, too, which you can't do on a regular light pen. It just flashes the screen and then flashes the screen.
So you find the light pen by scanning the whole screen?
In a regular raster, it has to do that. Like if you're using a light pen, you'll see it scan all the way down, either the whole screen or it scan only down to where the light pen is. Initially, I guess you have to scan the whole screen, but that's just like for 1 second.
My memory of playing with the light pen is you have to move the light pen around
until finally. It's the alignment issue.
Once you're there. Once it picks it up, it's very, very good.
Well, but that's
if it doesn't, but if it right. doesn't,
but that's software, right? Which he didn't know. Whoever did the program, I think it was Moskowski did that program. I think. He was a great programmer.
Yes,
he didn't do so great on that. Maybe. He was.
Whose idea was it to come up with overlays? Because once you went vector, you knew you couldn't do colors.
The people who were really concerned about the fact that there wasn't any color. I mean, it was really a marketing decision. It was the case, you know, I thought the overlay, I wasn't really happy with the overlay, especially for Slamble. People don't use it. They take the overlays, they set it down on their table, and they put their drink on it so they don't stain the wood. Right? But I think it was a serious concern because of the fact that, you know, people were really worried, this isn't color. And, you know, there is, you know, it's got to have color. And so I think that was a marketing concession to try to make sure that even though it wasn't color, there was at least this overlay so you could have some, you know, it was a design marketing thing. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and they had, weren't there arcade games that had gold?
Yeah, they were great, like Star Castle and Armor Attack, but the arcade game had gold overlays too, so it gives you more of a reputation than the arcade game.
Well, color's not impossible.
There is a prototype, if I'm correct, that is colored, but at the point in time when we had to make our release, it was impossible. I mean, just getting 9-inch black and white out there in time, that was enough. If they had said, let's play around with color, forget it, they wouldn't have made it. I mean, it was clearly a marketing decision, go with what you think you can do. And then clearly, if the Vectrex had succeeded, I think the idea would have been to try and push into a color Vectrex to begin pushing to all these other things.
Yeah, I remember the video games died right after the Vectrex came. But it was, of course, only temporary until NES.
Yeah. That reminds me of a question. You once wrote a letter to Electronic Games asking if people were interested in further development, like if you could get some stuff together for the program. Is there much response to that?
Did I do that?
Yeah. Now, who was
that? That's a hardware question, yeah.
like about 10 to 15 years ago or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like, I remember one time running into John Hall at the Rose Cafe, and because I remember, you know, you remember, and we were talking about that. He had a bunch of games, but it was still at the point where people were still into maybe they should sell their games, or it wasn't clear everybody should give them. And then Jay owned the rights. Jay later gave it away or something, right?
I think this, you know, this also is the case with all good projects and a lot of bad projects. The programmers become very merry to them. And if it doesn't make it, the programmers just can't see it. They just come, we've got to do more. You know, you become locked in this world, and there's a sense of, well, you know, let's get more people to do more Vectrex. And, you know, it's a problem that you have if you've just worked with the soil and you put so much of your life and soul in it. You know, you're going to go down with the ship. You can't see it. Now, mind you, that does mean you get a few good games out of it. So, in hindsight, it works out well. But I think that was a lot of the motivation in it.
I was sort of misleading people. See, I have a box full of stuff, but I can't read any of the floppy. You know, the floppies are 8-inch floppy. I don't even have a computer that can read a 5-inch floppy anymore.
I printed hard copy of all mine.
That was smart.
Oh yeah. I did that for every game I did because I knew this meeting was going to be, you know, the media we were using to die. I got stacks of listings just because of the fact that I knew that if I ever wanted to go back to it, paper has survived since the Egyptians, and that's the right way to do it. No, I'm not giving it up. Don't even ask.
We have those toggle switch computers, I think.
Oh, yeah, we have the
S100
computers.
That's
what I'm saying. You come in the morning, you get to flip it, the lights and go on, and you know, it's nice.
If you find someone on the internet with an 8-inch drive who would be happy to read all that stuff off. Actually, even Livermore, there's a comic from Game Guy that's just, you can read any, that's like part of his job.
You would be good to do that now before it's like really unreadable. It's probably already, it's been 20 years plus.
Whether the
bits are still good. That's good for about one pass, the heads will take the oxide.
Is the string always vertically oriented, even when it's a handheld?
If I remember, I never saw a format that was horizontal.
Yeah, that was to differentiate it, definitely. That was the point of differentiating. Sure.
Yeah, that actually was a really good decision because it basically said you had, you know, the bottom and the top, which, you know, where you're throwing scores and other things, which is a long way to get to. We didn't have to mess with it. If we had had it switched this way, we would have lost a lot of prime game space. So it was a very good decision from the design point of view to, you know, get that information out to the furthest corners by doing it on vertical.
I guess you're not into HDTV.
I am into it, but that's about 26 years later. Yeah, I'm pushing this Vectrex with the 6809. I want anything I can get. Save me a cycle anywhere.
I still wonder though, seriously, on HDTV, where are they gonna, where did they put all these crawls down there?
That's a hardware question. I'm sorry to beat that one up, but this was one of the things that happened where we did, there really were the hardware people and the software people. The hardware people were really good. But at the same time, they're running on a really tight schedule, and we're barely getting any hardware to be able to do our development on. So it was sort of this continuous, whenever anything went wrong, hardware. But they did a great job. I mean, Jerry.
You should mention all John Ross. John Ross was really, they got him his own house to work out of eventually. They were expanding, and there wasn't enough room in the regular building. So they rented a house nearby. Mm-hmm. Remember that thing with the
sort of, I mean,
it was funny because you would have to know John, I guess, to know why it was funny.
But it was, he really did a lot of, really pushed the thing through, was sort of there all hours to do whatever was necessary to make sure that we could get as many development systems as we could into the hands of the software, software developers, so we could get it done, the hardware people.
He taught his girlfriend how to sign.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Anyway, the big model we had, I'm working on was sort of this view of, we knew how to fold the dang dip switches on our thing. We knew what to put. We never let them know, because if they ever heard that we knew what we were doing, then they never come to help us when we had a hardware problem. So we kind of had to lie through, we don't know what we're doing.
Do you recall what the slew rate for the beam, how many dots you had vertically and horizontally?
Which question? Both questions?
Both questions.
Both questions. Well, the resolution is easier. There's no resolution. It's whatever resolution you want.
You had a finite.
We didn't. That's what we. That was the hardware. That was the thing where if you look at the Atari Asteroids, it's a huge circuit board with a bit slice microprocessor, which means that they have these multiple chips, which are like the fastest kind of microprocessor at the time. They required a lot of support chips. And they, I believe, I don't really know, but I believe they were actually calculating in dot position, I think, where they were, and then just somehow put it out in vector.
Well, they had special ASIC.
No ASIC. They were these, I think it's from AMD, these bit slice chips. Where you manufactured your own microprocessor using, four of these bit slice chips plus a million support chips.
So they also had a custom chip that they did to.
Is that right?
Use a state machine of some sort that grew up for a lot of graphics.
Okay, I didn't know that. There was a custom chip.
But, if you have an 8-bit VNA, then you only have.
I consider that an excellent question. Thank you for answering it. Asking it. I will. Do you want to answer it also, or should I? This guy just likes to hear himself talk. We used integrators. It was great. The idea was you just take an op amp, one op amp section, and when you put a current into an op amp integrator, which is an op amp integrator, is you just put a capacitor in the feedback loop of an op amp. And when you put a current into the input, you get a ramp, which is a, as opposed to if you just put a resistor into a capacitor with a voltage on it, you get an exponential curve. But if you use this op amp integrator, you get a straight line ramp up with the voltage. So that's what we used. We replaced this entire circuit board with two op amp sections, which is out of a quad op amp, is half a chip. Because, so what you do is
I bet you don't even remember how you would make the vector on there. Do you recall?
He knew how to operate. See, to be a programmer, you had to know the hardware. Like you said, you don't want to admit it or anything. You had to understand.
There were registers that we had to push information into that we basically were sending text into, and that determined direction and speed. The big problem we had was just, we had a set amount of time, set amount of cycles, right, that we could do our drawing in, and that was it. We could have as much resolution or as little resolution as we want. We were just completely time-driven.
Right. Exactly. On the record. Right. That's what it was. Thanks for that. I'll remember that. Because the deal is, yeah, you had an 8-bit that you put into this. There were sampling holes for the voltage that went into the integrator. So you could set that up as 8-bit, but that just determined the speed that it would go. And then there was a timer. We used the same peripheral chip that was out of the VIC-20, which was a 6522 chip, which happened to have a timer in there that worked perfectly because the timer with the output of the chip would go low or something at the end of the timeout. So the output of the chip was directly connected to the output of these integrators. The input of the integrators. So it would just stop the voltage going to the integrator as soon as the thing timed out. So between setting the voltages and setting the time, you could do anything.
One of the things that we have when we were developing the Vectrex, Tom Paul wrote it, and Jerry took it over, was something either called the executive or run model, which version was used. It basically was sitting resident in the machine utilities that we could call for being able to drive this thing. So the developers actually were lucky. We didn't have to go in and do it raw. We did have effectively a layer of support, which we had coded in. We had trig tables in there. We had things to be able to do sounds on. So we did have a little bit of help in terms of some core code. So that's part of the reason why I can't really remember what we pushed into what, because my memory is I've got a subroutine I'm calling and I'm feeding in on the X and Y, but the accumulator, the necessary information, go boom, the beam is now up there. I don't remember the stuff underneath it because that was John Hall and Jerry, the layer which would then go in and do it.
Well, that brings up my question about the slew rate. I remember Spinball, noticeable sections, these on my machine.
Because you gave me that number. That was the case you always bumped into with these games, the fact that you had a finite amount of time. For example, in Scramble, one of the really nice things I did bump into is I actually had a few cycles left over. It's one of the reasons why I think it's very, very stable. You don't bump into the problem, for example. I lucked out on the game.
It was really hardware limited. It's just the deflection, the yoke of the magnetically deflecting yoke on this vector. That was the limitation of the slewing, actually, because you needed more power to be put into that to get a higher slewing. And there was a limitation on what hardware could be used to drive this yoke, what power supply, and everything. It ended up being a monolithic chip. Because it saved a lot of cost. It's like a car radio amplifier or something like that, that John, selected for that. But then, we could have had a higher slew rate with big TO3 transistors and a bigger power supply than we've been afforded. It's always these trade-offs. And it was a toy business also. We weren't really in the video game business. It was more the toy. It's all toy oriented, so just every penny is important.